Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And I'm not. I'm Jill Heller.
And today we're going to give you that long-promised follow-up discussion. You might remember earlier this year we had a talk about Stephen Baxter's Proxima, and both Tim and Jill gushed over the book, how much they enjoyed it, and then lamented how long they had to wait for the sequel. Well, the sequel is out now. It's called Ultima, and they've read it, and there's more gushing. And I will let them gush.
Should I go get a mop for the amount of gushing that's about to happen?
You should be prepared.
You should, yes.
Yeah. Mop, box of tissues. We're good. Ready. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So if you may or may not recall, Proxima was the story of humanity's first steps out to the stars, and then the discovery on the planet of Per Ardua, which was a tidally locked planet in orbit of Proxima Centauri, these artifacts called the Hatches, and they allow people to traverse between worlds where Hatches are. There are also these items called the Kernels, which are basically miniature little wormholes that humanity has learned to tap for their energies in order to drive starships at high fractions of the speed of light. Unfortunately, a war breaks out in the book Proxima in the solar system. And in the course of that, Mercury, the site of a bed of kernels and a hatch, is utterly obliterated. We follow then Steph Kolinsky and Yuri Eden as they come through a hatch on another planet into a world where the Roman Empire never fell. And thus begins Ultima.
Okay.
In which we find that not only are the hatches a possible portal between worlds, but also a possible portal between multiverses. Because not only do we get a universe where the Roman Empire never fell, and the eagle of the Roman army flies over many different planets, we also end up going to a universe where the Incan Empire never fell.
And
visiting an O'Neill-type colony that the Incas have built out of the dismantled moon. And that's only scratching the surface of it.
It's like the further we go, may I bring up the fact, what we noticed is as we go further into the book, each variation becomes much more violent. Despite the in expectation of what the historical, if it had pulled all the way forward, would have been.
Yeah, one really fascinating thing, Summer, how spoilerific do you want us to get?
I'm going to say go for it.
Okay. Let me start by saying this book is dense. Part of the reason it took us so long to get to this point to review it is because it took a long time to read, to digest, to mull.
To breathe in between chapters.
Yes. Baxter does an amazing job of building believable worlds, not only in terms of a planet around a distant star, but also what it would look like to have a star-faring Roman Empire, and what it would look like to have an O'Neill-type colony in orbit around the Earth as built by a technologically advanced Incan Empire.
Wow.
The research is incredible.
It doesn't leave... There's no gaps in your head about how this could be plausible. You don't really need to suspend your belief to be able to put yourself in that space.
As we follow through what are the characters end up calling John Bar hinges, where a major cataclysm occurs, and then all of a sudden our characters find themselves projected into another multiverse. You see them come to terms with how that universe has changed, with the cultural mores are different. And the one that really struck home for me as our characters, Steph and Yuri, and the Call You, which is a artificial intelligence, are going through normal space back to Rome. Baxter does a great job describing how an interstellar spacecraft built around a Roman army legion would look like, down to the point where the hold full of slaves, which are starting to become diseased, they would let them die because they know they've only got but so many supplies and so much life support available that they actually calculate and count on some of them dying so that they all have enough stuff to get back to Earth.
Wow.
Yeah.
That became one of those things where we have to stop in between chapters because I need a break to deal with the humanity aspect that is just not sitting well with me.
Now, you had said that Proxima was a very dense book. Does Ultima take that to another level?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness, yes. It's
Yes.
like somebody amped it up to 11.
But the other thing is, what's really fascinating is that it never really felt like it dragged. And while there were moments where I kind of felt like, maybe Baxter's showing off just a little bit of what his research is, the flip side of it is that you get such a feeling not only for the worlds that he's created, but then all of a sudden the humanity of his characters really come home in terms of that universe that they're in, and what they're facing, what they're fighting, and what they're sacrificing. For example, especially in the Incan space station, there's a scraggling Roman century has made it through, and the centurion Quintus Fabius is trying to figure out how to get his people back out again. And you begin to wonder as they get in deep, the Incas recognize that there's something not quite right about these Romani who say that they're ice farmers because Rome fell in this particular timeline. But okay, they can always use strong backs. So they lead them deep into the jungles of this space colony. And yeah, eventually they find their way out. But part of what they have to do is offer up a young girl as a potential human sacrifice for a ritual sacrifice that takes place at the hub city. And as a diversion, Quintus and his remaining legionaries basically challenge the Incan army to a battle. And you know that as much as you begin to care for characters like Quintus Fabius, you begin to realize he's not going to make it out. And Yuri Eden, who is basically the first character you meet way back in Proxima, he dies about a quarter of the way through Ultima.
Okay.
And all throughout, part of what Baxter does is give you the sense of how, this becomes a multi-generational story. And at no point in time does it ever feel forced or like it's okay, and then all of a sudden 10 years have passed. He might
All
give you
right.
a couple
Take
months
one
have gone
down,
by.
pass it around.
Yeah,
It's not Game of Thrones.
characters who feel like they're minor characters, like Titus Valerius, who's a one-armed legionary. He's this gruff guy, and every time something happens, he goes, "Why? I remember this one time on
On
campaign," and everybody's
campaign.
like, "Oh," they
Shut
start
up.
right. At the end of it, he's leading basically a half dozen of the surviving characters back to Per-Ardua, which is at the end time, which is the end of the universe. And you've grown to love him, and his You know, while you never would have thought he was officer material, he certainly leads everyone like it's an expedition, and it helps give them focus so nobody falls apart.
I think that was part of his character, is without that purpose, he has no sense of his sanity would be gone. And that was one of the few things he had left for all the jumps that he had made.
It's great. At the very end, they're at the Terminator of Perardua. Again, it's a tidally locked planet. Does not rotates once per revolution. So they're standing on the Terminator, and some of the characters, Steph Kolinsky and Beth and Mardina Jones, they've climbed a peak, and they managed to get a glimpse at the dark sky, which you can't, obviously, from one side of Perardua. And they see the Andromeda galaxy hanging large and low in the sky.
Wow.
Okay. Well, they call, you know, Titus Valerius comes back from a scouting expedition. They said, look at this. He looks up and goes, yeah, so? Come see what I found.
So it sounds like no matter what universe, multiverse, parallel world we're in, everybody is always going to know that crotchety old master sergeant or master chief who has all the stories and gets everybody to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and fight to the end for whatever.
Right, exactly. Yes, yes. And wow, this doesn't even really touch the big theme, the big story, which I think is kind of a favorite of Baxter's and gets back to the space opera aspect of all this. Turns out, and spoilers ahead, boys and girls,
as if the last 10 minutes weren't completely spoilerific enough.
There are two artificial intelligences, Earthshine, who is an artificial construct made up of originally 8 or 9 different human beings back in the early technological past, like the 22nd century, one of whom was Yuri Eden's father. And the CALU, the colonization unit, who was on Perardua at the beginning with Yuri Eden and Mardina Jones and other pioneers, they begin to realize the bigger picture. And that is, there are the dreamers. The dreamers are the large, slow-moving communal mind of microbes that make up the noostrata of any given planet. All the bugs that we found here on Earth, and by bugs I mean microbes that love living in extreme situations where radiation is hard and you're down miles into the planet.
All of the extremophiles.
All the extremophiles. They really make up one giant communal mind.
Whoa.
And they've reached out through space to find other planets with such communal minds. And the problem is that because they think on the time scale of millions of years,
billions plus,
the end of the universe or the end of the multiverse is a fairly imminent proposition for them. And so to try to think about things faster, on a faster scale, they have tapped the energies of the end time barrier. Pull that backward through time to create the kernels and thus create the hatches, and use complex organisms like human beings to help transmit themselves between planets so that they can talk amongst themselves. And in an attempt to try to forestall the end time, they smash up the different primal timelines to jump to other timelines where they can get human beings making hatches far more readily and far sooner in the history of the multiverse. So in the prime timeline of Proxima, people have found the hatch, but they don't know how to make them. They have the kernels, but they are very hesitant to use them. Well, that's not good enough for the dreamers. So the Romans are really handy about learning over in this multiverse. So they're really handy about learning how to use kernels. And sure, they use them in war on Earth, but yeah, whatever. But they're pretty good at making hatches. But that's still not fast enough. So they wipe through cataclysms, they wipe out that timeline and hop over to one where the Incas really, they basically have denuded the entire planet of Earth and are just making hatches left and right. Mm-hmm. And
so wait, they intentionally destroyed the Roman ruled multiverse in order to provide enough energy to jumpstart the Incan one.
No, it's more like a better way to look at it is like they're sifting through sheaves of paper,
mm-hmm.
with different qualities of universe on each paper. All right, well, on this on page one, it's basically our timeline. No, we don't like that one, so tear that paper up. What's next? Oh, the Romans kind of kept going. Yeah, they're pretty good at this, but that's still not fast enough. What's on page three? Ah, the Incas. And as Jill noted earlier, they get more the societies become more brutal and less about the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the dreamers, they don't see complex life for they see us more like social insects, like ants.
Mm-hmm. We recognize that there's some sort of communication, but we can't be bothered. This is just so insignificant to our grand scheme, to our grand timeline, really.
I'm still wrapping my brain around parts of that.
Oh, believe me.
We had to stop and go back quite a few times.
It's astounding the sweep and scope of these two books.
Wow. Were there ever any parts in either book? I mean, now that you've read the second part of the duology, was there anything that rang a little not quite so massive or just slightly false, or did this book hit you over the head on all the right notes?
Well, the only thing I felt was a little deus ex machina was toward the end of Ultima, as Titus Valerius and Steph Kolinsky and Beth Eden Jones and her daughter Mardina and Chu Yen, who was once a slave, he's carrying the Kalyu in a pack on his back, and Titus's daughter Clodia, they are making their way from the substellar hatch on Perardua to the antistellar hatch, which is on basically the frozen side of the planet. And, you know, they've got a handmade cart that they've lashed together with wood that they found. You know, they're foraging for food as they go. They cross the Terminator and they find these gravity tunnels, which are basically tunnels carved into the surface of the planet that you start off at one end. It's a perfectly frictionless surface, and just using the gravity of the planet, you can zip through to the terminus, or the other end of the tunnel rather, in roughly 40 minutes. Baxter has an afterword where he basically breaks down all his research. It's amazing. And it turns out these gravity tunnels were predicted back in the 18th century?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So it's apparently an old idea. But it's pretty handy for our people to kind of find them when they did.
It was a little too handy.
Yeah,
so
it
was more of a right time, right place, because it had to be kind of thing, more than a hand wavy them kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It was a little too convenient on the part of the writer. Now, he kind of writes it off by saying, well, it's the Perardua at the end of the universe 14 billion years from now, if you will. And who knows what civilization had risen there, built these things. You know, it makes sense because you've got a hatch at the substellar, you got a hatch at the antistellar. So it's a point of interest. You can see where a civilization would build some way to get there. But yeah, it was kind of – that was the only place where it was just a little too tidy. Okay. To find something like that.
All right.
The only other thing that I kind of wrestled with was that Earthshine and Kalyu seem to have almost unlimited energy to do what they've got to do. But, you know, that's technology. It's really not a hard leap to posit a tiny fusion engine or, you know, microcell or whatever that's pulling energy from the quantum foam. I don't know. He doesn't really explain it, but
no, but he does. But he does postulate earlier on that there was a like a specifically with the call you that there was going to come a point at which it was going to be non-functional. It was going to, in essence, burn itself out, and that never does happen. So, at some point, did somebody tinker with it? Plausible.
Yeah, but other than those two little bits, it's why while it is multiverse in scope, again, Baxter never lets you forget that there are people involved. And at the very end, as our last little scrap of humanity is waiting for at the end of all things, my God, it's heartrending. That's the only way to put it.
Oh, my goodness.
We usually refer to, you know, tearjerkers by the number of boxes of tissues you need to grab. I think we had to double down by the last bunch of chapters.
Yeah, it was. Wow. Well, and it starts early. There's, you know, a one point in Ultima where Earthshine, the artificial intelligence who starts to really suss out the nature of the dreamers. He wants to get their attention. We're in the Rome universe. And so over a period of years, he's managed to manipulate things, events, such that he's got Ceres on a collision course with Mars.
Oops.
Yeah, well, and then the dreamers there go, hey, wait a minute, no, you're going to wipe us all out here on Mars. They build, you know, make a hatch appear so Earthshine pops through, and as it turns out, it's the hatch off to the, you know, to the end time. But one of our characters, Penny Kolinsky, and she's old at this point in time. I mean, she's 80, 90 years old, and she knows she doesn't have much time anyways, and so she decides to stay behind, and it's kind of like at the end of Childhood's End, summer. The guy who decides to stay on Earth as the children are starting to tinker with the very fabric of reality.
Right.
Matter. It's that kind of a feeling. She's just, okay, here's what's going on. Yeah, I'm feeling this. It's getting big in the sky. And then the transmission ends. And you just kind of go, oh.
Yeah, that last chronicler is always the heartbreaker, because you know there's no way out. You right. absolutely know they aren't serving any purpose. Their sacrifice doesn't help anything, doesn't prevent anything, doesn't save anyone. It's just, no, I'm going to stay here, tell everybody what's happening as long as I can. Boom. Wow.
Yeah, and I think part of our mood from having finished the book was we really felt like we lost a family.
Yeah.
You know, and at those different stages throughout the book, it's like, oh, we've, you know, this, my heart is ripped for this character gone. You know, but it lingers. It lingers with you, and you still feel that angst and the pain as the book continues.
So how would you rate both books, like out of 5 stars?
Easily 4.5.
Okay.
So I would say that I would rate, Proxima probably more like a 4.5, and Ultima probably more like a 4. It was brand new to me in the first book, so.
But you would highly recommend both of them to fans of sweeping space epics. Slightly, I don't know. Is there anything less hard than hard science?
It is truly a definition of hard science fiction.
Okay.
As fantastic as it is with the notion of a Rome that never fell and an Incan Empire that never fell.
Yeah, also universe.
Right. The flip side of it is clearly Baxter did his research. It isn't just, Romans in space, la la la. You know,
it's a dinosaur on a spaceship.
but it's clear that he examines what exactly that would mean in both and how those cultures in the past would translate into a starfaring culture. The notion of the noosphere with extremophiles. That's very hard science fiction. The notion of wormholes not only as potential doors through space, but also through time. Like I said, in the afterword, it's a 3 to 4 page afterword where he references scientific papers and books and speeches on all of this, archaeological through cosmological.
Mm-hmm. Is there an indication of how long he had been researching this before he started putting it together as a story?
You know, that's interesting. I
don't recall having seen how long it was mentioned.
No, because there was also, he references in the afterword, one or two papers or speeches that were published last year. Yeah, talking about the primordial gravitation waves detected by BICEP 2 in Antarctica. That was first announced in March 2014.
So but, we have research spanning from the 1800s to 2014. Holy cow.
Yeah, 17th century, by the way, for the gravity train.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Well, I don't think he started his research back in the 1700s.
No. I imagine that he probably has been working on... Well, I don't know. It's hard to say.
I would actually be curious. It's like, when did you start researching these to put together for this story? Because that level of depth that you're talking about, both from the science involved, the sociological aspects of the civilizations involved, and the personal side, that's wow. Okay, impressed. Golf clap.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Or he never sleeps.
Hey, he could never sleep. We don't know. Wow.
Yeah. In the end, at the very, very end of the novel, three humans, Mardina and her newborn baby, Gwen, and the father, Chu Yen, who was originally the slave boy who was carrying the call you, they get sent back in time by the dreamers, or back in time and to another universe, and that I won't spoil for readers because it's like jaw-droppingly cool and disturbing all at one in one fell swoop.
It does leave open the possibility for a third book that way, but I don't think it has enough momentum at that point to be able to continue it full. I think it's come full circle. It's done.
Yeah. Okay.
The big reveal has been made.
Yeah, I did, like I said, a little bit of digging right before this. Actually, I did a little digging last week. And it doesn't seem like there's a third book. This isn't a trilogy. This is a true duology. And...
Yeah, it's seriously, if you like mind-bending science fiction on a truly cosmic scale, pick up these books. Baxter has rarely disappointed for me, and he certainly has not disappointed in this particular instance.
And now I'm curious, if there are audiobooks, how long are they and who narrated them?
I just want to know how they pronounced half the words out of the empire.
And there were times when I was reading out loud, and I was just kind of going, blah, blah, blah.
He was making up words.
Baxter in his afterword even says, a useful recent reference on the Incas is Kim McQuarrie's The Last Day of the Incas. And he says, anglicized spellings of Quechua terms vary. I have aimed primarily for clarity. And we're going, oh, really?
It's not surprising that the Inca Empire fell. They couldn't understand each other.
You know, boy.
It's just difficult.
Oh, boy. So I will take it that you highly recommend these books for fans of hard science and space adventure. And golf clap to Mr. Stephen Baxter for another set of well-told, complex stories.
Yes.
For us to enjoy.
Yes. And I must say that I am mourning the loss of access to those characters. they have infected our daily routine, our thoughts, and our what ifs have often flowed back to these characters. And for them to be gone is truly a loss. And there are a few books that affect me on such a level where it'll be, weeks before it's like, I'm all right, I can't read anything else for a little while because I just need to be able to mourn the loss of my characters for a book that will not continue. But it was amazing, absolutely amazing. And not just Golf Clap. I'm pulling the gloves off and I'm going full screen with the big clap.
Audible.com says that it is Proxima is narrated by Kyle McCarley and is 17 hours 53 minutes long.
You must be talking very fast.
As a note, the audiobook has an overall rating of 4 out of 5 stars with 195 ratings. Various different people have given the audio performance and the story 4 or 5 stars. Everywhere you go, you're gonna get 1-star reviews. Seriously, people?
Sure, of
Really?
course.
Really? Are you that negative? I mean, geez, I
TLDR.
know I'm cranky, but holy cow. And yes, I have my moments, but come on, please.
Well, I mean, to that point, these books require a certain amount of patience.
Yes.
They are dense.
Ultima, same narrator, Kyle McCarley, clocks in at 21 hours, 55 minutes. Also, a rating of 4.1. 46 people. Well, it's still rather new. Holy goodness gracious, really? The regular Audible price, direct from Audible, is $41.99. Yeah, and Proxima was $34.99.
Okay, and then going through Amazon, you can pick it up for like,
Half
what,
that?
$8 for the Kindle version with the extra $4 on the WhisperSync voice ready? So that's on the Proxima, and yeah, like $13 for Ultima.
And is that the full audio or is that the Kindle WhisperSync?
The WhisperSync.
Okay, because I think those are two different products. Now I'm curious. That makes no sense. You know why? Because Amazon owns Audible.
Okay, I'm looking. I'm looking with Audible. Well, it says free with your Audible trial.
Yeah, they have a
Yeah,
three.
you're right. Buy with one click, $35.95. Holy moly, mother of pearl!
It is 21 hours and 55 minutes of narration. That's an entire day. That's
Oh,
a
yeah, we
full
have a
day
long
with a nap.
drive.
That's a full day with a nap.
Yeah.
Those different prices make no sense because Amazon owns Audible. What are they doing? Anyway, I will save my Amazon rant for another day, like a day when I have something else on Amazon for people to buy. But I think we can close out our discussion of Ultima, wrapping up our Proxima arc very nicely. And recommend both books to people. Go check them out. Thumbs up, people.
Thumbs up.
Excellent. Proxima, Ultima by Stephen Baxter. Both are available from your local book retailers, your local ebook retailers, your local audiobook retailers. We will have links, and we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hello, audience. Listen to your podcast player. Now back to me. Now back to your podcast player. Now back to me. Sadly, it isn't me. But if it stopped playing pop music and switched to the Dragon Reel podcast, it could sound like me. Look down. Back up. Where are you? You're in a movie theater with the podcast your podcast player could sound like. What's on the screen? I downloaded it. It's a swashbuckler with a magic rapier. Look again. The swashbuckler is now an evil sorceress. Anything is possible when you listen to the Dragon Reel podcast and not music. I'm on a unicorn.
Listen to Dragon Reel, the fantasy film podcast at dragonreel.com, or subscribe on iTunes or wherever great podcasts are found.
You're home from the comic book store with your favorite titles. Wouldn't they read better while listening to Krypton Radio?
Well, that will do it for this episode of Slice of Sci-Fi. We could have more book talk in the future. Still not sure how I'm going to get the Writers After Dark show off the ground yet, but it's not like it's going anywhere, right? Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas is progressing nicely. I am confident that despite the holiday schedules that make everyone's lives so busy this time of year, you will get a new Ninjas episode by New Year's. There. We have a lot of highly anticipated sci-fi entertainment coming, well, to Sci-Fi Channel and a couple of other channels this winter season. In December, we have Childhood's End and The Expanse starting on Sci-Fi Channel. I'm looking forward to both of them. And in January, we have 12 Monkeys returning and also The Magicians starting. So that's a full slate of some really good sci-fi and some highly anticipated good fantasy coming along. I really should read the books The Magicians are based off of one of these days. Additionally, we have Shadowhunters coming to ABC Family in January, based on the Mortal Instruments book series, of which there was a not-so-well-received movie, so hopefully the TV series will fare much better. I have a little bit of a good feeling of this one, because I like what ABC Family did with Stitchers. So if they maintain that level of storytelling and character engagement, I think Shadowhunters could be fun. But that's what we have in store. I don't know, does Agent Carter return in January or later? I know some people are looking forward to that. We will continue to keep an eye out on all the new TV series that are coming out on the major networks, on the cable networks, and of course on our favorite online / streaming / video on demand entertainment sources. So if you have any comments, anything you're looking forward to, let us know. Call in your questions, comments, suggestions. That number is 602-635-6976, or you can record a message on your own equipment and email that to summer@sliceofscifi.com. Go over to iTunes, leave us a review over there, tell us what we're getting right, what we're getting wrong. Check us out on Twitter, @sliceofscifi and @sliceofscifiTV. We got some more stuff coming up there. Check us out on Facebook. Check us out on Google Plus. Search around for Slice of Sci-Fi. You'll find it. And as always, there are the websites, sliceofscifi.com, sliceofscifi.tv, and the newly updated kickassmysticninjas.com. Thanks to everyone for your donations. Every penny that you send us goes to keeping all this geeky entertainment online, the websites, the media, everything. Everyone who signed up on Patreon, thank you. Thank you for your support. It is very much appreciated. You can go over to patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi to read up more about that, on how you too can contribute to keeping all this fun on the air. And as like I said, as soon as that new Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja show is ready, we're dropping the flag over there. So keep an eye out. Subscribe. I had to fix the feed, but it should be operational again, I hope. If it's not, if you run across a problem, as always, let me know. But that will do it for this episode. We will return with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.